It's time for another edition of Political Rewind. I'm Bill Nygut. Glad to have everybody out there with me today. You know, the legislature, we're now down to 3 days left in the session today. Tomorrow they adjourn on Friday, day 40, which makes it, what, June 26th, a session that normally ends the first week of May around that time, or late April. Of course, it was delayed by the pandemic, and they have raced in the final 11 days to get as much of the important stuff done as they can. And we're going to spend time talking about that on the show today. And for that, very happy to be joined by Donna Lowry. Donna, of course, the host of Lawmakers on GPB television, the single longest running show in Georgia television. Donna, way too young to have even known about the show.
That's
right. First went on the air many, many years ago.
Yeah,
hi, Donna.
That's true. Hi there, Bill. I'm thrilled to be a part of this show today.
I'm glad to have you here, too. Greg Bluestein, political reporter for the Atlanta Journal-Constitution, has also been down at the Capitol covering some of the news down there. But, Greg, you continue to cover political campaigns and everything else you can get your hands on. You're sort of insatiable when it comes to finding political stories to cover. But thanks for being on the show today.
Yeah, it's going to be interesting once the session ends, because the campaign will really begin. It already has begun for some of these federal races, but it really begins for all these legislative races too, because they haven't been able to raise money. They haven't been able to, you know, focus their attention on their own reelection campaign. So it'll be a big difference come Monday.
Before I introduce our final panelists, I want to quickly say, I sort of think of you two, Donna and Greg, and other journalists like you, you're kind of warriors in my mind. You're out there. I mean, look, I continue to shelter in place. As people know, I do this show from the shelter of the spare bedroom in our house outside of the city of Decatur, and I continue to not go out into the world very much. And there is something daunting, I think, about the two of you, especially at the state capitol, being able to go down there and work. And all I can say is thank you both for doing that. You're bringing us news that we need at least some risk to yourselves. Does it feel that way to either of you?
Well, I don't feel that I'm at risk at all. You know, we signed up as journalists to cover the news no matter what comes up. And so we do our best to protect ourselves. But I think our main goal is to make sure we are telling people what's taking place. And so whatever that takes, I mean, we've done interviews where some lawmakers wearing masks, some are not. Once we, you know, I put a microphone in front of their face, they say, should I keep it on? Should I not? I give them the choice. And I've been keeping my mask on, of course, but the main thing is to make sure that we get the information that we need to pass along, you know. So we do what we do. Right, Greg?
Yeah, we've got our masks on. We keep socially distanced, covering the Senate, especially yesterday in the gallery. I mean, people are not remotely close to each other because we've got the press corps has the entire gallery to spread out on them. But look, we've covered protests. We've covered rallies. We've covered political events. I covered Kelly Loeffler's first in-person event just a few days ago up in Gainesville since the pandemic. So, you know, we still have a job to do, but we have to be safe and careful when we do it.
Well, personally, from my point of view, thank you for being out there reporting important news on our behalf. Karen Owen is with us. I'm really always glad to have Karen back on the show. She, of course, is a professor of political science at the University of West Georgia. Karen, you're getting set to go back out on the front lines, too. You're going to start classes, I guess, in August. And the university's system is trying to figure out ways to make in-person classes as safe as possible. But it's daunting, isn't it?
Yes, and we are with all plans to go back in August. I think West Georgia will start in August 12th, and we will see what it looks like. It will be a little bit different, but I think we all have to be careful and smart in how we get back out into the world.
Karen, in addition now to being a professor of political science, spent time working on the Hill when Nathan Deal was a member of the U.S. House up there, worked in his office. So we always enjoy having your insights as part of the show. All right, let's get going. Donna, last night, the legislature, I think, had a historic moment. Tell us what they accomplished and why it matters.
Well, it actually, you know, as you mentioned, we've been coming down here for a while. I've certainly been coming down for more than 30 years. But I think yesterday, that having the Senate and the House both pass the hate crimes bill was an amazing day. The feeling down here was different from anything I had experienced before afterwards with so many, you know, this bipartisan push to get a hate crimes bill through and then having it happen. The votes in the Senate, only 6 people against it. And in the House, 38 people voted against it. The Senate went first. The words on the floor, the different speeches on the floor were very impassioned. Some of them were emotional. There was talk of people told their own personal stories. But then there were people who just wanted to let everybody else know that they were kind of late to the party in terms of understanding the problems with embedded discrimination, as Senator Bill Calzert put it, that we can't deny or run from some of the things that have been happening in the state, and that certainly the video of Ahmaud Arbery right here in Georgia made a difference in terms of the minds of everybody. So he pushed this bill. The big stumbling block, as you know, was that last Friday that the Senate Judiciary Committee added, actually it was rules, I'm sorry, actually added that police and police would be a protected class, those who are first responders. That was taken out. There was a totally different bill for that. That helped a lot of people feel comfortable about the hate crimes bill. And so that bill passed first, then went over to the House and it passed. But in the Senate, there was just this feeling of, we've got to get this through. And they were able to do that. And then it went straight to the House. We didn't expect it to happen so quickly. Turn around over in the House, not a lot of discussion there. And then it passed over there. And then of course the House Speaker, who had been talking, he'd actually been talking about the number of days that had elapsed since the House passed the version back in 470 days, back in the last year. And so the Speaker was just elated, and there was a lot of feeling of, you know, unity, and we worked on this together, and this is what we have now, and Georgia's going to be better for it. I know you were there, Greg. So
Greg,
your thoughts. Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, it was
Greg, it was very go ahead.
Yeah, the word history was thrown around a lot, and Bill, you're right, it was very emotional. I mean, I've been covering this since it was struck down. A previous statute was struck down in 2004 as unconstitutional by the state Supreme Court. And it looked like, I mean, how many times have we written the story about the perennial battle for hate crimes legislation just going nowhere? And this was clearly a law that was set to go nowhere, a proposal that was set to go nowhere again this year. And it took, as unfortunate as it was, it took Ahmaud Arbery's death to really spur it to traction. Right after Ahmaud Arbery's death, the House had already passed this last year, but it was bottled up at the Senate committee. And when we broke for the coronavirus hiatus, there was no talk about even getting a hearing in the state Senate. So that shows you how the demonstrations, how the protests, really how the national conversation over race and justice have really played a significant role in Georgia's legislative process. And Ahmaud Arbery's mother, shortly after it passed, said, "I'm glad my son did not die in vain." So very, very, very emotional, passionate speeches you heard. As Donna mentioned, in the state Senate, it was just a string of people speaking. Only one opponent that I can remember who spoke, Bill Heath, but everyone else was supportive. And a lot of them brought their own personal stories about their own awakenings. Or in the case of State Senator Renee Unnerman, who converted to Judaism a few decades ago, her own encounters with discrimination and anti-Semitism. So passionate speeches, and something that we do not usually see on the floor of either chamber.
Karen, I think it's maybe important. Greg mentioned that the state Supreme Court overturned the hate crimes law that was put in place back at the turn of the 2000s. I think they passed it in 2000 or 2001. It worked its way up mm-hmm. to the state Supreme Court. And lest people fear that this measure, assuming it's signed by the governor, and there's no reason to think he won't sign it, is also destined for a date with the courts, it's very different. The court ruled back in 2004 that the language in that hate crimes bill was too broad, too generalized, and therefore you couldn't distinguish what a hate crime was and who it protected. The court wanted enumerated classes, essentially, and this bill lays out very specifically who's covered in this measure.
So I think that lawmakers now, knowing that a bill was overturned, you know, a law that was overturned, they're very careful when they go in to write something now because they have the knowledge that they need to be specific and lay out those classes so that if a legal challenge does emerge, they can defend it well and show why they have the intent behind what they've written and who they are definitely protecting. You know, I think, too, here it shows politically that our lawmakers are paying attention to the public and desires of people to see change. And I think this shows, you know, both Donna and Greg mentioned the unity, the bipartisan support. It also shows that our legislature, in a time of crunch right now, right, when the focus probably they thought was going to be on budget issues, they can actually govern. They can do something that can be effective and make a difference in people's lives. And I think that's kind of nice to see that we do have lawmakers stepping up to do that.
Well, Karen, as long as you've got the ball, let me continue with you, and then I really want to hear Greg and Donna on this subject as well. The fact that, as Donna pointed out, there was an effort in the Senate over the weekend to include police officers and first responders as part of the protected classes suggests that there are members of the Senate who wanted to send a very different political message. That they wanted to make it clear that their hearts lay with police who have to deal with protesters who are put in what they think of as vulnerable positions in a shooting situation where they may or may not have been justified in shooting. And so I'm setting all that up to say the fact that there was a significant proportion of the Senate that seemed to be willing to go along with that makes me wonder if, yes, they passed the bill, yes, it will probably become law, it's important symbolically, but it tells me that it isn't as if the hearts and minds of everyone in the state legislature have been won over by the need for this kind of justice. What do you think about that? And then I want to get everybody else in the mix.
Well, I think that we can't divorce the idea that lawmakers, legislators, they have a vast group of constituents. And so they're not just talking to one group of people. They have to think about those in the district they're representing and how they're going to get reelected. And so sometimes that reelection piece can weigh heavily. And they think about, you know, they need to talk to a base that's going to turn out to vote for them. And so some of these senators in the state probably recognize that their voters are also supportive of law enforcement and wanted to see that support written into the bill. But I think, you know, at the end of the day, it's very smart that if you want to see good public policy made, sometimes you have to split those interests. And so first, the hate crimes bill needed to go through. And then two, you can create another bill that maybe does speak and protect those in the first responder class and group, but you don't have to lump them together. So it doesn't become so political that it becomes more about the governance and protection of different people.
Yeah, I think you're right about that. The Saturday session was a rare session, and it was interesting that it came right off after the decision was made to add this protected class for first responders. And Senator David Lucas got up in front of the chamber and just with tears in his eyes, passionately talked about the fact that it did not make sense to add an occupation, especially police officers, into a hate crimes bill when you had police officers who were considered a part of the problem. And so he was very, very passionate about that, said he would not support it. It looked like things were not going to happen with the hate crimes bill with that. But as I understand it, apparently through the rest of the weekend and through this week, there was a lot of negotiating going back and forth. Early in the week, I heard from people such as Dean Calvin Smyre, who's been there for 40-something years, and he said that it looked like they were going to be able to do something with it, that it would come out of the hate crimes bill. It did. And then it made sense, I guess, to, in order to get those who were kind of really struggling with trying to go with the hate crimes bill, to have a separate bill that would focus on it. So I think there was a lot of back and forth. There was a lot of talk about that yesterday, about both sides getting together, sometimes angry with each other, sometimes yelling. There was some reference to the fact that they really did have some tough times. There were some apologies even yesterday on the floor to people they may have said some things to during this period of time. But in the end, they had come together to put something together that they all felt very proud of.
Yeah, I mean, look, if you look at the leaders of the legislature, they had both raised the stakes so high on passing this. Calvin Smyre, you just mentioned, said it would be a catastrophe if no hate crimes law passed. Lieutenant Governor Jeff Duncan had gone on national TV saying that he basically promised that a hate crimes version of the bill would pass. Look, I want to focus on a number, though, 31. And that's the number of new votes in the Georgia House that voted for the hate crimes bill yesterday, as opposed to last year. Last year's 96. It barely passed. It needed 91 votes to pass. 96 lawmakers voted for the last year's version of the hate crimes bill. Yesterday, that number rose to 127. And if you look at those new yes votes, they're not just from the suburbs, although several of them are. They're from small town swing districts. They're from rural areas. They're from exurban areas. So Republicans around the state, there's still a lot of no votes, of course, but Republicans around the state had sort of their own reckoning and joined this. And one of them is Houston Gaines of Athens. He's in a very, very tight district. He competitive district. He voted no against it, last year. And this year he said he was glad to get it across the finish line, and that the addition of reporting requirements and changes to stiffer penalties made the difference to him. So they found different reasons to do so. But it's interesting looking at those 31 lawmakers who changed their minds between this year and last year.
You know, Karen, it's really fascinating. I ask you this as a political scientist. It's really fascinating sometimes how social movements are slow to take hold. They kind of, you know, metaphorically drag their feet. They can't gain the kind of momentum that the people who are advocates for whatever the movement is are hoping for. And then suddenly, bam, something happens that accelerates it into the public consciousness in a whole new way. I would argue that the issue of gay marriage, and in fact, the whole acceptance by society of gay people, was an example of that. All of a sudden, something that had been considered outside of the norm became entirely acceptable. It is interesting, that, by the way, and I'm going to make that same point about hate crimes, it is interesting that for years, one of the reasons the General Assembly refused to pass a new version of the hate crimes bill after the Supreme Court threw out the old one was that there were many members of the General Assembly who did not want to include protections for gays and lesbians. That's another significant aspect of this bill. This is the first piece of legislation that recognizes and embraces the LGBT community in Georgia and says they are deserving of protections. So, two things there. I don't mean to talk so long, but number one, our acceptance of the LGBT community has grown in an accelerated pace. And number two, as a result of Ahmaud Arbery, as a result of George Floyd, as a result of Rayshard Brooks, suddenly race consciousness has exploded on the scene and people are getting it in a whole new way. And the two kind of come together in the way that this bill went through the legislature.
Well, you're absolutely right that legislators seem to sometimes be slow when they look at addressing some public policy problems or issues. And it does take a very significant point in time or action or an event that actually moves them to do that. I mean, we saw that in the civil rights movement, right? That it was national television that showed individuals getting harmed by police that pushed the Civil Rights and the Voting Rights Act. So I think history shows that lawmakers do act when there's national attention on an issue crisis, and then they'll move. And I think you're right. So with the hate crimes bill here in Georgia, there was some hesitation because of the language that included the protections for those who are gay and classifying those to have that protection. I think last week we saw when the Supreme Court issued forth its recognition to write about the LGBTQ community, that there was, again, this is a group of individuals that we are identifying. We do want to make sure they're okay. And I think that allowed the General Assembly to move forward. I think they had all those pieces coming together that they had to act. They had to show that they could provide some protection in the state. It was no longer going to be a smart thing for them to ignore it and be slow in that action.
But a lot of that, Greg, is because they recognize that their constituents and the people of this state had a sea change in their recognition of the need to protect, among others, African Americans from discrimination, bigotry, and racial crimes. So that's part of all of this enormous change we've suddenly gone through.
And really, it's tragic as it is, it took the death of Ahmaud Arbery, it took the death of George Floyd, it took those graphic videos for people to see for it themselves. And Democrats have always been pushing for this. Democrats have been pushing for this since 2004. So Democrats, since it was struck down by the state's highest court, so Democrats have been bringing this up. And of late, suburban Republicans have made it their calling card too. But it also, so what it meant is it took conservative white Republican leaders like David Ralston, like some of those people who switched the votes, some of those 31 who switched the votes, their votes, to step up and say, like a Senator Bill Kousert of Athens did yesterday. He gave him a 20-minute kind of opening where he acknowledged his own concerns and his own mindset that was troubled in the past, and kind of checked his own privilege, I should say, and said that it's time for Georgia to pass it. So in a way, those conservative white Republicans gave their colleagues some cover. They weren't going to go out. A lot of these lawmakers weren't going to go out on the limb and join Democrats if not for that forceful support from people like Bill Kousert or David Ralston.
Yeah, and
I've got to get to a break, but
okay. No, I was just going to say really quick, the other person who I thought was fascinating in his speech was Senator Jesse Stone, whose committee held up the 426 for a whole year. And he said bluntly, it's because we just didn't have the votes. And he actually said bias-motivated crimes incite retaliation. And he was very, very passionate about what he had to say on the floor.
One last question, and then we really do have to get to a break. Greg, I noticed that Ahmaud Arbery's mother, in praising the legislature for passing the bill, said she looked forward to being at the signing of the bill when Governor Kemp does sign it. There's no reason to think he won't. But typically, a big, big deal like this, if you're a governor, you quite often want to do something in a ceremonial way to make a larger point about this. I wonder how the Kemp folks will in fact deal with this. I wonder if they'll sign this quietly, knowing that there are still people who aren't in accordance, don't go along with this idea. Or I wonder if they will try to do something that invites an Ahmaud Arbery's. It's going to be interesting to see how they handle the signing, isn't it?
Yeah, or if they sign it in companion with the more controversial companion piece, HB 838, which adds more protections for first responders and police who were targeted by crimes, which Democrats said was the sort of low point of the day for them, was that it had to pass in order for hate crimes laws to pass. So if he does that in tandem, I was kind of, once it became clear to me that this was going to pass today, and I was emailing you earlier yesterday a little cynically, but we still thought, we still figured it was going to pass yesterday. Once it became clear, I was kind of joking with the governor's staff saying, when's the signing ceremony? They have not thought that far ahead, but they did make it very clear that they will sign this after a customary legal review.
All right. We will watch to see how all of that unfolds. By the way, Andrea Young, director of ACLU Georgia, was on our show yesterday, and she was very unhappy about 858, which does, in fact, add even more protections for police in their and first responders in their encounters with citizens, and feels that they now are like triple protected in and that it was an unnecessary measure. And I'm sure we're going to talk about that at some point down the road as that bill comes close to signing too. All right, let's get to our first break. We're running a little late right now. Let's do that. More stories out of the legislature when we come back for more on Political Rewind. Welcome back to the show, Karen Owen, political science professor, University of West Georgia, Donna Lowry, host of Lawmakers on GPB TV, Greg Bluestein, political reporter, lead political reporter at the Atlanta Journal-Constitution, who is my partner on these Wednesday shows. Donna, let me start with you on this. Sharon Cooper won a victory, something she sought for a long time. The Senate approved a maternal mortality bill that she has really been passionate about for quite some time now. It's based on the fact that she, as Sharon has pointed out over and over and over again, Georgia has one of the worst maternal mortality rates in the United States. And, of course, its impact on black women is even more significant. Yet another example, in addition to the coronavirus, of how African Americans are disproportionately impacted on health-related matters. So it passed yesterday. The problem is it's only symbolic at this moment.
Just yesterday, it passed with in the Senate with unanimously. And it extends Medicaid to low-income mothers from 2 to 6 months following the birth of a child, which is less than what everybody wanted, which was a year. They think that it should be extended to a year because there are there's so many postpartum problems that these mothers can encounter that it has nothing to do with just the birth, the initial birth of the child. But they were able to get that and get it through. But there is no money for it, of course, because the budget has been cut. So it's almost symbolic in this sense. But, you know, Sharon Cooper has been very adamant about pushing this through. So has the Georgia Legislative Black Caucus. They've really been pushing for something to be done when it comes to maternal mortality. The fact is that Georgia has a maternal mortality rate that is worse than some third world countries. And so it's very dismal in terms of black women in particular. They are 3 to 4 times more likely to die when they become mothers than white women. And so this has become a big problem. And so to get something passed at all is a big deal. And we had a lot of talk about this by a lot of senators, black and white, before the legislative break. But certainly this was a big lift for Sharon Cooper, and so I think a lot of people would be happy about that. So now, money. Now we got to figure that out.
Yeah, now, Karen, they've really got to put something behind this. You know, it strikes me, if I wanted, Greg talked about being a little cynical a minute ago. I wonder if it's fair to be a little skeptical, somewhat cynical right now. Yes, it's a victory for Sharon Cooper. Congratulations to her. There is no money right now. There's a big election coming up in November. The women Republicans are more worried about women voters than they have been in a very long time. This is the kind of measure they certainly hope they can run on to attract women voters back to the fold. Yes?
Yes, and indeed, you know, Donna mentioned that it passed unanimously, and that shows that this is really not a partisan issue in the fact that it's really about the health of women and securing that. You know, the partisan part will probably become later with the funding and how it is actually funded, but it is for Republicans an opportunity to run on something in November and talk about how they are addressing some of the health issues. I think, too, this is a key point for voters and people in the state leadership to think about party leadership, particularly who's sitting at the table. So if there are more women sitting at the table in these discussions, then it makes sense to me. I see it as a political scientist where this issue becomes more of a priority, and therefore in the next legislative session, it becomes part of the funding discussion much more than other maybe priorities. So I think we have to think about that. Like when voters are sitting at the ballot, you know, filling it out at home, if they're doing mail-in or if they're actually able to get to the polls, then what will they be deciding? And part of that choosing of a, you know, a member of the General Assembly is the priorities they're going to push. And I think that this is one that we'll have to see if it's going to be, you know, as top of an issue for a lot of voters like education is.
Greg?
Yeah, and remember, next year is going to be an entirely different landscape at the state capitol. Even if Democrats don't take control of the Georgia House and flip 16 seats like they're aiming to, I think both parties acknowledge that at least it'd be a tighter margins for Republicans no matter what. And so different things could push to the forefront. Last year, we were all talking about the anti-abortion heartbeat bill, right? The bill that generated so much controversy and vows from suburban women who used to maybe be Republican who are now thinking otherwise, that they would take revenge at the polls. And now the talk is about you know, this sort of Medicaid extension waiver plan and hate crimes. So things change in a year. I'm not saying people will forget what happened. You know, people who are upset about the anti-abortion bill will forget about it. But next year could bring a whole new set of priorities, just like the pandemic kind of shaked up this year.
Let's talk about another issue. Gambling has suddenly, Greg, shown its face again in these last few days of the session. Ron Stevens, the chair of the Economic Development and Tourism Commission, committee, is pushing it to bolster the state's economy. He wants the legislature to vote for a referendum that will allow the people of Georgia to decide whether we should have gambling. In these final few days, Greg, is he really going to be able to get anywhere with this?
Oof. I mean, anything can happen these final few days. And so you don't say, you know, you never say never. But you talk about a perennial issue, just like hate crimes, but one without sort of a, you know, a groundswell of support behind. Gambling is a step too far for so many conservative Republicans. Although, you know, there have been statewide polls and even a statewide primary vote, a non-binding primary question that showed a majority of Republicans do back casino gambling to fund education. It's still such a hard hill to climb right now. And you also don't have the outward support of Governor Kemp, who said he won't veto legislation, but he also won't specifically back it. So that one kind of needs a vocal champion, too, to give Republicans who might be on the fence some cover. And you don't have that quite yet.
So Donna, here's what's interesting to me about this. I mean, that what this measure would do is to allow voters, I think I'm right in saying, just to pass a ballot referendum that says, yeah, we're open to having forms of gambling in Georgia. That could be sports betting. It could be pari-mutuel wagering. It could be casinos. What's interesting about this, Donna, is that early in the spring or late winter, there were really strong advocates pushing hard to allow sports betting as a reasonable way to get Georgia into the legal gambling business. And we know that the four major professional sports teams in Georgia came together and to lobby in favor of sports betting. Well, here we are toward the end of June. There's no sports to bet on anymore, Donna. It seems that measure's not getting very far right now.
Yeah, I think right now those four, the heads of those four sports organizations are so focused on whether or not they're going to get seasons back up and running that they're not as concerned about that. Although, you know, it is a revenue stream. They did push for that, but it just doesn't seem like there is a stomach for it down here at the Capitol and for people who are just adamantly against it and don't see it being the big revenue stream that some might think it might be. So I don't see it going anywhere, but I, you know, there was just momentum going and then the coronavirus pandemic shutdown hit, and things have really changed when it comes to that. So I think, as Greg said, it will be it's a steep hill for a lot of people here for them to get this to go through. But they will try. They will try.
Well, I mean, the argument that the state needs revenue right now is a fairly significant one. But if they're not going to go there, I'm fascinated by the fact, Karen, that there's also, despite the fact that it's on the table, the notion of raising the tobacco tax in Georgia. We have one of the lowest tobacco taxes in the state. Advocates for raising the tax say you could come up with $500 million or more in additional revenue if you raise the tobacco tax. The Speaker of the House is adamantly against it because it's, I think it's safe to say, it's just another example of Republicans opposed tax increases, period. Yeah?
Yes, I think that's probably correct, right? Like going into an election year right now, you don't want to be the ones that have passed a tax increase, whatever that tax increase is. You need to be able to run that you've kept taxes low for the citizens. You know, interesting about the casino, and I think, you know, Greg mentioned that Governor Kemp hasn't been, you know, out forefront either supporting it or, you know, talking about it. And it's different than when we passed the Georgia lottery. So when Governor Miller was at the forefront pushing for it, and it was very clear where that money was going. He had three things he pushed for, right? Pre-K, college, and technology. And with this, it doesn't seem like this the political will is behind being very specific where that money's going. They talk about education, but you can read, of course, in the AJC about how one of the buckets is the state general fund. And I'm not sure voters are going to say, hey, we want all those to just go into the general fund, right? Like, you get conservative voters behind things when you put it very much earmarked to education. I also wanted to make the point that it's interesting, if it does pass, whether there will be a very good religious organized attempt to get that constitutional amendment measure on the ballot to fail when you don't have a lot of people right now in church. And going back to the lottery, you know, opposition came because people were hearing from the pulpit, or they were actually getting brochures on their cars at the time to oppose it. And I'm curious if it does get through, if we'll actually see that happen again, or how the religious community will react.
Greg, that was a great little history lesson. Zell Miller in 1990 ran on the issue of passing a state lottery. And as Karen points out, he did it in a very smart way. He earmarked in specific language that it would go to pay for pre-K for the Hope Scholarship, which, of course, emerged as the most important aspect of it over the years. Zell might not really appreciate that necessarily, and technology. And he learned a lesson, Greg, because Karen also talked about general fund now for some of the money that would be collected now. He learned a lesson of Florida. Where Florida, when they established their lottery for education, the money did go into their general fund. And what Floridians learned was that because it was in the general fund, lawmakers started reducing the amount of money they put into education as they did their budgets every year. That was a long way of saying you better be very clever about how you approach an issue like gambling revenue in the state.
Clever and tight with your language, and it needs, and it seems like, at least in Zell Miller's case, that it took a tremendous amount of political capital to get that passed. Things have obviously changed since then. But there's a lot of, I think, legislative confusion over these laws, too, because we've seen these proposals. We've seen so many different types of gambling proposals over the last, let's say, 6-8 years. We've seen promises from MGM to build $2 billion casinos in downtown Atlanta. We've seen, we've heard them being called destination resorts and plans to build in Savannah or maybe near the airport. Or no one's, if you ask the average rank and file lawmaker what the stance is, what this year's approach is, I think there's a lot of confusion because the bill keeps on changing. And of course it needs to change in order to pass. But there's some murky road ahead. And I think that needs to be one of the casino advocates' main missions is to, you know, have a clear defining purpose and a clear message about where this money would go to.
Our friend Brian Robinson, a frequent panelist on the show, contacted me yesterday. You know, he's been working with the Fox Theater lobbying on this, because there are coalition. There's a coalition of arts organizations like the Fox, like the Woodruff Arts Center, like other performing arts groups that are very nervous that if you allow casinos into Georgia with their big emphasis on shows, on big show, floor shows, that it will have a devastating impact on the arts community. The only problem there, Donna, is Brian Robinson's a good lobbyist, but legislators are not necessarily all that clued in to how important it is to save the arts.
Unfortunately, I think you're right about that. I get their point, and it probably would hurt them tremendously, but I think their focus is more on some other issues. It's interesting, right before the for the break, on Signy Die, I'm sorry, on Crossover Day, we're going to get to Signy Die on Friday. On Crossover Day, the former mayor, the former governor of Mississippi, Haley Barbour, was there at the Capitol, really working at the crowd, trying to get them to pass casinos and to look at this bill. But then, you know, as we said, that we had that break, so I don't think it went anywhere. So I really think it's going to be a heavy lift for them to try to get something through this time. But I guess the feeling is do a little bit now and we'll see where we can be in 2021. And as we've learned in the last few months, anything can happen in the next few months, in just a few short period of time.
All right. Donna Lowry, you got the last word of this segment. We still got a few more issues I really want to get to on this edition of Political Rewind. We'll do that after this break. Greg Bluestein, after the meltdown that took place in many polling places on primary day here in Georgia a couple weeks back, the Speaker of the House, David Ralston, called for an inquiry. He wanted to put together hearings to see where things went wrong. We saw finger pointing back and forth. Secretary of State's office on this show said, hey, we did everything right. Not our problem. Fulton County, DeKalb County, you're to blame for all this. Yesterday, Raffensperger was called to testify, and he kind of repeated the same message. He said the state's voting system worked well. The problems were mostly issues in the counties. A lot of legislators did not respond particularly well to Raffensperger's message.
No, he got grilled. And he acknowledged that what happened was unacceptable, but again, he laid most of the blame on Fulton County and its long known problems. He also said that elections officials need to add voting locations, improve training, and he laid out some plans to have more technical support on hand. But he continued to insist that really the problem wasn't with the voting equipment. He said just 14 pieces of voting equipment had to be replaced for mechanical issues, but that figure did not account for the troubles poll workers faced with inserting encoding cards and check-in table polling issues and hooking up electronic equipment properly, and also all the voting machines that were taken out of service because the folks, including people I interviewed on that day, just didn't have the technical support to get it done.
Karen, the reason this matters, not as looking back but looking forward, is if the Secretary of State's office, as the overseer of the elections, sure, Fulton County, DeKalb County, other counties that had significant problems have got to do their own soul searching and come up with solutions. But if the Secretary of State's office doesn't take this incredibly seriously, as Representative Shannon from Decatur said to him yesterday, it's not going to work. It's not going to be good enough for you to just keep saying it's Fulton County and not my issue. And then she said to Raffensperger, what specific policies are you going to put in place? And until we start hearing about things more than the generalities, oh, we need more training, we need more this or that, there's no reason to feel confident about what happens in the August runoff election and then in November.
Yes, I think there's great concerns about what will happen just in a few short weeks in these runoff elections and then what can happen in November. I would imagine And obviously, I'm not at the Capitol. I'm locked in at home. But I would imagine that the Secretary of State is having a conversation with his staff about how are we reaching out to the counties? What are we going to be talking to the counties about? Because he probably felt like, as we mentioned, he got grilled yesterday. He has to have some answers. He will be running potentially for reelection in a few years, and this is going to be an issue that can always be brought back up if you don't handle the administration of elections well. And so I think he's probably working with his staff to talk about how they're getting involved with the counties. I think one thing that we as voters need to consider, too, is the election happened in June amongst so many different circumstances that we had new voting machines that we were trying to learn on. We had social distance going into the polls. Poll workers who are normally there, trained well, weren't there. And so I'm not trying to give a pass to any county or any person, but I think we also have to understand that that is a unique time when we were voting with a lot of new changes and uncertainty. And hopefully now it's pressed upon our leaders that before August and November, they're really working out those kinks.
Yeah, Donna, that's precisely the point. We are quite likely going to be in a very similar place in August. What is it, the 24th, I think, is the runoff date, something like that. And maybe in November as well. So, there were, you know, these problems, this crisis that hit us for the June primary was bad enough. But if we've got to figure out how to have decent elections, even if we're still facing the same problems in the runoff and then in the general.
No, absolutely. So we're going to still be dealing with COVID-19. You're still going to have the people who are more the vulnerable population of older people who are usually poll workers are going to be reticent about going to be poll workers. So they've got to come up with more, you know, for more people. And remember, leading into all of this, Raffensperger kept saying, we had training, people have been doing things, we're so ready, and things failed. So he's got to figure that
all
out.
Right.
And it wasn't just Fulton County that was a problem.
Yeah.
Greg, we've only got a couple of minutes left. I'm going to start with you on this. So the coronavirus numbers, very unfortunately, are starting to tick up in Georgia. Spike is a word that I'm a little cautious about using because it may suggest a bigger increase than we're having right now. But there's no doubt that the numbers are increasing, and they have been increasing since the Memorial Day weekend, and we don't know what's going to happen moving forward. It's interesting, Greg, that Van Johnson, the mayor of Savannah, has now said that as Chatham County cases increase and as he anticipates tourists coming down to the Savannah area and the seacoast, he wants to make masks mandatory. It's interesting, once again, where we have a mayor who seems to want to take the lead on protecting his citizens.
Yeah, and that's not something that Governor Kemp has ever included in his statewide executive order, so it's not clear if that supersedes anything that Van Johnson in Savannah would like to do. Certainly Kemp has been wearing a mask in public himself, so he's kind of contrasted himself with President Trump and others who have not done that. But there's been an increase, a marked increase in rural areas as well that is very concerning to state officials and public health experts. And just recently, emergency beds that were once housed at Georgia World Congress Center have now been shifted to Middle Georgia to cope with what could be an increase in hospitalizations there. So officials are very warily watching these increases, and I think we're gonna start seeing some effects of that.
I was staggered last night watching the rally in Phoenix where President Trump appeared, where you had thousands, a couple thousand people probably in that mega church. Nobody was wearing a mask. I mean, virtually no one was masked. People were interacting very close distances to one another as they mingled. They sat next to each other. They cheered. They carried on. And I have to say, this has now become personal for me because I now have family members who are part of the spike in the hottest state in the country right now who have COVID-19. And Donna, I do give the governor credit. Governor Kemp has modeled wearing a mask. And I have to say, thank you, Governor Kemp.
Yeah, he certainly has. And he's doing it, but there are a lot of people down here who aren't wearing them. The Senate isn't required to wear them. So I can't imagine Van Johnson being able to get anybody else to do it if you can't get some of the lawmakers to do it down here. But yes, he has done a great job modeling his mask.
Karen, you want to get one last word in on that?
Well, I was just going to say, it is tough to get people to follow any type of rule, right, when it involves the face covering. But I think what we're seeing a lot across the state and the country is people are letting their guards down. They're trying to get back to normal. They want their lives back. And it's really hard to want to think about it. I mean, it's difficult to know that this is where we are, but we need to be paying attention to the numbers and what's happening with the virus.
So, absolutely. Okay, so here's my soapbox moment. When I hear someone say, oh, well, I'm not wearing a mask because, oh, I'll either get the virus or not get the virus and I'll deal with it. What I really hear them saying is, I'm not going to wear a mask. And if I get the virus, I'm going to end up giving it to you. That's what they're really saying. So that's me on the soapbox for just a moment. All right. We are completely out of time for today's show. Donna Lowry, it was really a pleasure to have you. Good luck these last couple days of the session. You too, Bluestein. We'll look forward to seeing your reports, Donna's reports at 7 o'clock at night on GPB TV. Karen Owen, always great to have you with us. My thanks to our team, Tom Faust, Jake Trower, Jesse Neiswanger, Sam Burmistaws, for everything you're doing to keep the show up and running. We're out of here. Back tomorrow. Take care. Stay healthy.